Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey gang, we've been away for the holiday, but we're back this week with a story about change and how you know when you've got it or when you don't. A heads up for people who don't like profanity, there are some swears in here, but you know, sometimes politics is enough to make you cussin' mad. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
My name is Alexandra Perez. I am 44 years old. I live on 32nd and Hardy.
Alexandra Perez lives in a small two-story house on the southwest side of Chicago. And for most of her life, aside from a few years growing up in Mexico, this is where she's lived, inside this same one-mile radius, in a predominantly Mexican neighborhood called Little Village.
Yeah, I was at Pulaski and 30th, and from 30th and Pulaski, when I got married, we moved into this house, so I just literally crossed the street. That's all I did.
She's got a cousin next door, another one around the corner. Her roots here run deep.
I am a Chicago Public School 8th grade teacher, bilingual teacher. I am raising my three children in this community still. And I don't see myself ever leaving this community. Mi Villita is my home. This is who defines me, and this is who has defined my children, and we're very proud to live in this community.
When we spoke with Alexandra back in the spring, the COVID-19 pandemic was still in its early, most frightening weeks. She and her family had been staying at home, observing the governor's shelter-in-place order.
Those few first days, I mean, I didn't even want to peek out the window.
And it was during that time that something happened in Little Village, something no one would have expected during a pandemic. Early in the morning, April 11th, on the Saturday before Easter, Alexandra was still asleep when she was jolted out of bed by what she at first thought might be an earthquake.
We were awakened by the shaking of the house. A couple of things fell off the wall.
Alexandra is somewhat used to loud noises. Her house is just a half block down from a set of train tracks. And beyond that, there's a shuttered, almost 100-year-old coal-fired power plant where construction work has been going on for over a year. But the sound that morning was different. Alexandra's son described it like the 4th of July times 100.
I was upstairs, came down to the house, and I asked, "Did you guys feel that? Is everybody okay? What happened?" And then it all clicked to us. I said, "Oh, the explosion."
Workers at that coal plant site had imploded one of its smokestacks, an old towering concrete column that had always been one of the tallest things in the whole neighborhood for miles and miles. Alexandra had been using it as a landmark when giving directions to her house for years.
The old smokestack of the former Crawford coal plant came down in spectacular fashion on Saturday.
Drone footage of the implosion, picked up by all the news stations, showed the first explosion at the base of the smokestack. It looks like the beginning of a rocket launch, but instead of shooting like straight up in the air, the structure kind of tips over like a falling tree. And as soon as it hits the ground, dust just starts clouding up around it and moving like a slow-motion avalanche.
A smokestack implosion over the weekend caused a dust cloud that spanned for blocks in the Little Village neighborhood.
A plume of dust pouring over the surrounding community. Maclovio Orozco.
The dust expands across the empty property grounds and past the train tracks, and eventually just swallows up Alexandra's house. Then her neighbors' houses and rows of houses beyond them.
It was just unbelievable because that dust looked like it was a big cloud, and the only thing I thought was thinking was like this is probably how it looks when cities get bombed.
cars had to drive with their headlights on. People got caught in the dust, and they reported chest pain, trouble breathing.
La caída de la torre causó una pila de humo en el vecindario de la villita este sábado.
Most residents had only been given a half day's notice. The company that owns the coal plant site, it placed flyers around the neighborhood just the night before. Organizers in the community that had seen this coming, they had pleaded with city officials, don't let this implosion go forward, particularly during the lockdown. After all, the zip code in and around Little Village, it has reported some of the highest confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the whole state of Illinois.
This is an outrage. This should have never have happened, especially with COVID-19.
Residents who were already concerned about COVID-19 now say they have to worry about what they may have breathed in on the morning of Holy Saturday.
This implosion, it is part of a much larger, much longer story in Little Village. A story about a group of residents like Alexandra who got together and began to demand justice for their neighborhood. And I'm telling you this story now because I think there are a lot of people all over the country who can suddenly relate to that experience. People who are joining old movements, who are starting new ones. And maybe as a result of that, I keep hearing this question. Is this it? Is this the moment of real lasting change? But you know, having covered social justice movements for a couple of decades now, I know that the answer to that question is annoyingly complicated. And the best way to wrap your head around it, to understand what it really takes to make that kind of lasting change everybody wants, is to follow a story like this one, the ongoing story of the fight for environmental justice in Little Village.
At this point, everybody's pointing the finger at everybody, right? Because this is the hot news right now. But then we know what happens to all that. It boils down, and then they forget about us.
Our reporter, Ginny Casas, has the story from Chicago.
People call Little Village the Mexican capital of the Midwest. It's this vibrant neighborhood of small homes surrounded by little yards. The main drag is full of Mexican groceries and restaurants, places to shop for a baptism. It used to be an enclave of Polish and Bohemian immigrants. Today, there's an arch that reads, Bienvenidos a Little Village. And to understand how and why this neighborhood was swallowed by that dust cloud, you have to meet Kim Wasserman.
So we are in the Little Village community, which is technically the South Lawndale community.
I found this video of Kim from about a decade ago. She's giving a driving tour around Little Village.
Little Village is home to 108,000 people who all live within a 5-mile radius.
She grew up here, lived here almost her whole life. And Kim used to do these driving tours all the time, 3 to 4 times a week.
We are the second most densely populated Mexican-American community outside of East Los Angeles.
Keywords Kim uses when describing what it was like to grow up here: house music, graffiti, hoop earrings, paleteros, eloteros, murals, music, and people everywhere. But she wasn't giving a driving tour because of the great food or the great vibe. In the stop and go of traffic in this video, Kim was taking her passenger to a place she didn't know much about until she was 21, when she gave birth to her first son.
9 pounds, 8 ounces.
Kim has told me a lot of these stories over the phone, where we've gotten to know each other at a distance. Her kid was born in April 1998, and by June, he had had his first asthma attack.
And I just remember sitting there and the doctor being like, okay, do you smoke? Like, what did you do when you were pregnant?
Kim had had a healthy pregnancy, so the doctor started asking her about where she lived and the air quality in her neighborhood.
And I was like, well, shit, if I know, dude. Like, I've lived there pretty much my whole life, but fuck if I know what's in the air. And so that motivated me to go back home and start to understand what was in the air and what was in my neighborhood. And what did you know? There was a goddamn coal power plant.
A coal power plant called the Crawford Generating Station, the one just down the street from Alexandra's house. It had been burning coal in Little Village since the 1920s. Of course, Kim always knew the Crawford plant was there. The site is huge, over 70 acres. And there's that tall smokestack that marked the neighborhood from miles away.
It's always been in the background, and very much in the background, a huge-ass building. You can't miss it.
But what Kim hadn't realized was just what kind of health effects came with living near a coal plant. Dozens of studies have proven that emissions from coal plants expose people to toxic gases and heavy metals like lead, mercury, and arsenic. Things known to damage lungs, brains, and other organs. And not only that, 5 miles away in the next neighborhood over, there was another coal plant. Chicago was the last major city in the country to have 2 power plants burning coal within the city limits. Little Village is home to a lot of industry. Scrapyards, factories, a former Superfund site. Zoning rules have put these kind of industrial sites right next to homes and schools, with almost no say from the local community. The neighborhood has some of the highest exposures to air, water, and land pollution in Chicago. A 2002 study done by Harvard researchers found that the coal plant here and the one down the road could be linked to 2,800 asthma attacks and 41 premature deaths every year.
I've had 2 kids since then, and all 3 of my kids, unfortunately, have asthma. And, you know, it was important for me as a mom, just wanting to understand, did other people care and what could we do about it?
There are plenty of people in this country who live next to a dirty factory or some sort of heavy industry. Some might move, some might just accept it. But for Kim, the only option was to close the coal plants down, to get them out of her neighborhood.
Literally, as a community, we would like to see them shut down. They don't have a contract with the city or the state to provide electricity to us. All of their electricity is sold on the open market. And so that's a huge problem for us because these are basically cash cows for Midwest.
To do that, Kim started volunteering with a group of residents called the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, or El Vejo for short. The group had been working to get polluters out of the neighborhood since the early 90s. And pretty quickly, Kim became a full-time paid organizer. The Crawford coal plant, it became her Goliath, and she threw every stone at it that she could find. They protested outside government buildings. They made elaborate signs, a giant papier-mâché puppet of an evil-looking corporate exec.
Hello, I am the coal baron. I have come to take your children and your lungs from you. For what? For profit, of course.
They organized after-school programs and hundreds of those driving tours around Little Village.
You name it, we did it. Like, if you had an idea, most likely we were going to run with it.
In one protest, El Vejo gathered 41 high school students, one to represent each of the premature deaths estimated in the Harvard study. The group met in front of Richard M. Daley's office, then Chicago's mayor, part of the family that ruled the city's politics for decades. Daley had shown zero interest in closing the coal plants. So there, on the 5th floor of City Hall, each of the students slipped into a body bag, zipped themselves up, and laid out scattered on the floor with asthma inhalers in their mouths.
You know, because we were just walking in, we didn't have any signs or anything. And then, yeah, we just passed out the bags, and then before you knew it, there's, you know, a bunch of people laying on the floor in body bags. So, yeah, it was pretty cool in that sense. But I just remember their reaction.
Kim says Daley's staff were livid.
They were like, don't you ever do this again. Like, you embarrassed the mayor. They were more worried about the mayor being embarrassed than the guy they had the issue at hand. But we had no choice because it was the only way that we could continue to get the narrative out there around how fucked up the coal power plants were.
Kim eventually came to run El Vejo as its executive director. This campaign to shut down the coal plants, the fight to get the city and other Chicagoans to care, it dragged on for years. And it spread into every part of Kim's life.
You know, because my kids went to work with me for a very long time. And they understood why we were fighting the coal power plant campaign, why it was important. It was my middle son who really, every time we drive by the damn coal power plant, so mom, when are you going to close the coal power plant? I'm like, man, I am working on it. Like, stop stressing me out. Like, stop asking every single time we would drive by that thing. So, are you going to shut them down anytime soon? And I'm like, dude, I swear to God.
Kim was facing an uphill battle. The company that owned the coal plants, Midwest Generation, had allies at almost every level of Chicago city government. And if Kim and Elvejo had a hard time with Mayor Daley, they had an even tougher time with their own local aldermen. Aldermen sit on the city council, and the one in Little Village, Ricardo Munoz, received tens of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from the company. So did the alderman for the ward next door, the one with the other power plant. So Kim and Elvejo had to find an ally from a completely different part of the city.
I'm Joe Moore. I represent the 49th Ward of the City of Chicago.
In 2009, Joe Moore was a young, progressive alderman on the far, far north side of town. About as far as you can be from the Crawford coal plant and still be in Chicago. And Moore had a reputation for standing up to Mayor Daley.
If you look at the way city government is structured by law, we are a strong council, weak mayor form of government.
It was the first time Elvejo had anything close to the kind of political support they would need to do anything about the coal plants. But even then, Kim says Moore encouraged them to change their messaging and set their sights on goals he thought were more feasible.
He was like, you all are confused. He was like, you all don't really mean that you want to shut down. You all want them to get cleaned up. And we were like, nah, homie. Like, nah, that's not what we're at. We know what we're asking for. And he was like, that's not going to be politically viable. And so we spent a lot of time just fighting people who wanted to help us and getting them to understand that we knew what we wanted, that we didn't need them to change our messaging, that we didn't need them to change our strategy. In fact, that we just needed them to support us.
Moore didn't respond to our request for comment, but Kim says they were able to convince him that closing the plants was the only option.
I want to do what we can here within the city of Chicago to close two of the biggest contributing causes to global warming right here in the city of Chicago.
In the spring of 2010, Moore introduced an ordinance that would cap the amount of carbon dioxide and other pollutants that the two coal plants could emit. Basically, the message to Midwest Generation was clean up or close down. And the option to clean up was so expensive that if the ordinance passed, it would probably run the coal plants out of Chicago.
When this legislation passes, Chicago will do what no other large city in America has had the guts to do. Clean up a dirty power plant within its jurisdiction and thus protect the health and welfare of its residents. Yes.
At the City Hall press conference, Kim smiled and nodded. It was the first time she was inside that building behind a podium on the side of politicians instead of protesting against them.
Our communities have lived in the shadows of these plants for too long. And my hat goes off to the amazing people behind me for taking the initiative, for stepping up, and for saying that if the federal government and the state won't take action or it takes too long, we will, for the sake of...
So did it work? Did Moore's ordinance finally close down this power plant?
You know, it never passed.
See, Ginny, it makes me wonder, was Moore right, you know, in saying that Kim had unreasonable demands that were never going to be politically possible?
Well, I think Chicago politics is one thing. But if Kim's story has taught me anything, it's that organizing is all about patience. And even if this ordinance didn't pass, what she was doing was laying a foundation for what would eventually set up a victory.
How do you mean?
Well, think about when this happened, right? So we're in 2010. The Obama administration is really putting the pressure on the coal power industry. It's hard to imagine now, but the president of the United States was pushing clean energy everywhere. And once you add all that pressure that Kim had been putting on Midwest Generation at the local level over years and years and years, it created a momentum against these coal power plants that Chicago politicians couldn't ignore.
It's almost like it's a death by a thousand cuts.
So many cuts. And eventually, Kim finally got what she wanted.
I get this phone call from an organizer who works with us, and she's like, they're going to shut down. And I just remember just crying and just nonstop crying because it just was 12 years of just so much work and just so much heartbreak and just so much struggle. And to get to that point and just not at all be prepared for it. Never in a million years did I have the opportunity to actually stop and think, what would that moment look like?
Kim, Alvejo, they managed to do what they'd been told was unachievable. And Kim, because she was an organizer, she knew there was plenty of work still ahead. She just didn't know she'd be fighting this time in a dust cloud.
Have you ever heard of a time where it just works out? Like where the fight ends in a victory and that's like, that's it? It ends?
Yes and no, honestly. I hate to say that, but the reality is when you're dealing with a system that's based on structural racism, it's like you cut off the head and two more grow. There's a root cause to what these things happen, and usually it's capitalism and racism.
That's next.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
We start where it began.
In the life of a captive, life never got better.
From the dungeons in Ghana to New England's primary slave port, Boston, birthplace of liberty, was also the first colony to legalize slavery. As our nation struggles with the question of reparations, we look at how this long overdue reckoning is unfolding in the city that sparked the American Revolution. From GBH News, I'm Saraya Wintersmith. Join me for What is Owed, available wherever you get your podcasts.
If the 12-year fight to close this coal plant was a Hollywood movie, the story might end with that phone call Kim got that told her that the plant had been shut down. But this is real-life Chicago. After the closing, the city convened a task force, and it invited residents to daydream out loud about what they wanted on that old coal plant site. A zoo, a sports center, a community college. Many residents said they were happy to reuse the existing coal plant building for whatever they came up with. The important thing was Little Village residents just wanted it to be environmentally friendly, and they wanted to have a say.
Right, like up until this point, we had been fighting the city tooth and nail. And so to get them to be like, yeah, let's all come to the table, we thought like, a naive young person who's never run through this before, you're like, all right, cool, this sounds like a good idea.
But all of those ideas would stay as daydreams. Here's Jenny again.
Once they closed, the land under the empty coal plants became prime pieces of industrial real estate. And in 2018 and 2019, both were sold to a developer called Hilco Redevelopment Partners. The company is part of a giant international firm known for, among other things, liquidating the assets of failing companies. Think Blockbuster Video, Radio Shack, Borders Books. And Hilco's plan in Little Village was to demolish the coal plant to build a 1 million square foot warehouse and distribution center. Target has reportedly signed on to lease the building. The development is expected to cost $100 million and could bring with it loads of truck traffic, possibly negating a lot of the progress made in cleaning up the air quality when the coal plants closed. Not only that, the city council approved a tax incentive for the project worth almost $20 million, which meant Alvejo's next battle was going to be about how Hilco planned to demolish the old power plant. At a public meeting last summer that Alvejo organized in a community center auditorium, Kim voiced her concerns to state and city officials about toxins found in and around the building site.
Because the fact of the matter is, that site is over 60 years old, and it is very much contaminated with asbestos and lead, and it is going to be a difficult thing to demolish. And as community residents, we want to be sure to understand how that process is going to take place, ensure that our community health as community residents is protected.
One of those city officials there that day was David Graham from Chicago's Department of Public Health.
Hello, my name is David Graham. I am Assistant Commissioner for Department of Public Health.
Graham's job is to make sure demolitions in the city are done safely, that no one is exposed to toxins like asbestos and lead. And residents still talk about his presentation that day, almost a year later, because of what it didn't include, a plan to conduct air monitoring as the plant was being torn down, a step residents knew was critical for their safety.
Wouldn't it make sense, though, to have air monitoring at this location, given that when you burn coal, you have lead, you have mercury, you have heavy metals, you potentially have arsenic that's going out into the air, you have asbestos now. Wouldn't it make sense to have some sort of air monitoring at the site, even though they're not volatile organic compounds, because even though you can't see them, they're still as deadly, if not more?
So the question is, considering what the contaminations are on the site, why would your...
Graham's voice is hard to make out, but he tells the crowd he doesn't know what Hilco's plan is. Someone points out that a representative from the company is right there in the room.
I wouldn't recommend doing the air monitoring, but it's not up to me, and so...
Then he says he would recommend the air monitoring, but it's not up to him. The city doesn't require it, even though his agency's literal mission is to promote and improve the health of Chicagoans.
I personally don't understand how it could be up to the developers of the site to determine whether or not they want to invest in air monitoring for a community that they're not invested in.
Instead, Graham told the audience kids and people with breathing problems and anyone sensitive to dust should just limit their outdoor activity when work was being done on the site.
I would say to try to keep the doors and windows closed when you come in the house.
This community meeting took place at the end of summer, one of the last few months of good weather in Chicago. And this advice was given to an audience that made clear they didn't want a demolition or the warehouse.
All right, do you have one more question over here?
I just want to say this. I ask you, how do I protect myself from this is going on? And you tell me, close my windows and shut my doors? What are you doing to protect us here? I have a right to be in my yard. I have a right to walk to work. I have a right to breathe. So you need to do something. Not me, shut my doors, shut my windows.
And then this pandemic hit, and I apologize, I'm probably going to cry. We knew this shit was coming.
El Vejo closed their offices mid-March. Kim and her staff began working remotely at home alone.
Probably the second week of us being home, we lost our first volunteer.
A second volunteer would die the following week.
So I'm trying to manage grief in our organization, in our community, like checking in with our staff. How are you all doing? Can you guys work? If not, how do we support you? You know, and the worst question was like, are you prepared for somebody in your family to die? And do you need support?
Being isolated from each other was the complete opposite of how Kim and El Vejo had accomplished everything they had so far. And now they had to manage a new, much more imminent crisis. On the night of April 9th, 2020, Kim got a stock email from Hilco. Chicago officials had signed off on a permit to bring down the coal plant's smokestack using explosives. The city hadn't approved an implosion like this since 2005. But this one would happen with almost no warning in less than 48 hours.
I just honestly fell to my knees and I was just like, what the fuck? I don't think I've cried that much in my life. And it wasn't even when I got the email, because I got the email when I sent it out and we hustled and we tried that whole next day. We tried to stop it.
Kim calls everyone she can think of. People who live near the coal plant, the aldermen, people at City Hall, local reporters.
Then I got a call or a text from somebody we knew at the city who was basically like, I'm sorry. I tried everything I can and it's going to happen. And it's like, God damn, how many fucks can you not give about us as a neighborhood?
The implosion happened early Saturday morning. The explosives, the smokestack hitting the ground, those were the sounds that shook Alexandra Perez and her family out of bed.
The house looked like it was a little cloudy. And so then we looked outside and it was supposed to be a sunny day, but you couldn't even see the sun out.
Concerned residents flooded Kim and Elvejo's phone lines and email.
Just hundreds of emails and calls from people and just messages asking us so many questions and we couldn't answer them.
Questions like, why did the city approve this demolition just as the pandemic was sweeping through Chicago? Why weren't residents given more notice? Why was there so much dust?
And then there was questions around what was in the dust. How do I, like, I breathe it in. Do I need to take care of anything? What do I do? It's in my house. My kids were outside. Should I walk, you know, should they shower? Were my vegetables fine? Can I still continue to garden? Yeah, after that explosion, it was like, I'm itchy here, I'm itchy there. Sneezing and all that.
Alexandra says the experience left her jumpy. Any loud noise on the street, it has her running to the window.
And then I'm like, okay, you know, we don't want to freak out, but you do freak out and all these things come to your head.
Like what?
I was just like, oh my God, what are we going to get sick? Should I be Googling what the effects of asbestos are? What should I be doing? So, you know, should I be getting blood work done? So we're in the process of getting our doctor's appointment to get ourselves checked just to make sure that we're okay. I know a lot of people are going to say, well, you should have moved. That's not the point. The point is not to move. I'm going to move, but I'm going to leave behind this problem and leave it for who? For the next ones that come? That wouldn't be fair.
In the weeks following the implosion, it was hard to justify the safety risks of getting people together in person to protest the way that they always had. This was before the murder of George Floyd, before the protests that have swept the country. So Elvejo organized a demonstration, but everyone would stay socially distanced in their cars. The group would drive through Little Village, past the old coal plant sites, make a stop by Hilco's downtown office, and end up at City Hall.
So, yeah, I guess we're on the procession route now.
I caught a ride with Mauricio Peña, a reporter with the local news outlet Block Club Chicago. He's been following Little Village's fight against Hilco for the past 2 years.
How many cars is that, maybe?
Definitely more than 50.
We're wearing masks with the windows down in his little black Honda Civic and the line of cars snaking through the neighborhood. People come out to wave, take pictures, and yell in support.
Well, thank you all for being here this morning.
Elvejo hosted a live stream that day so people could tune in from home.
I know it's, you know, wasn't easy to get up earlier. You know, obviously we're out here dealing with all this craziness and we're all here together, you know, in solidarity.
So they're going to turn down to Crawford. Or down Pulaski to go to the Crawford, and they're going to cut, there's a road that cuts through.
Okay, so, we're passing Crawford Coal Plant right now. I think most people are familiar with Crawford Coal Plant. This was obviously the site of the implosion a couple weeks ago.
Aside from the smokestack, large sections of the power plant are still standing. Massive, torn up, busted out walls and exposed wiring.
We're still trying to keep this development from happening. Hilco wants to replace this with a 1 million square foot warehouse. This would be the largest warehouse within city limits. And it is. It would also bring hundreds, if not thousands, of more semi trucks to a neighborhood with already the second worst air quality in the state of Illinois. So we're really trying to stop this from happening if we can.
After the implosion, Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, held a press conference here.
Ready? Okay. Are you ready?
All right, good morning, everyone.
She promised the city would conduct a full investigation.
The demolition was permitted and scheduled and was supposed to be controlled in a way that kept the dust and debris contained to the site of the plant. The city was given repeated assurances that Hilco had a solid plan to contain the dust. Clearly, that didn't happen.
Lightfoot had the Department of Public Health test the air, the dust, the soil near the implosion site to get answers about what was in that dust cloud.
I would not tolerate this in my neighborhood, and we're not going to tolerate it here either.
When the results came back, city officials posted them online and assured residents they had nothing to worry about. Asbestos, which is known to cause cancer, was found at the coal plant site, but not in the dust samples collected off of cars in the neighborhood. Lead was also found, but at levels the city said, quote, pose no immediate health risk to residents.
It's really important to know that there's no such thing as a safe level of lead, and there's no such thing as a safe level of something that causes cancer.
We showed the city's lab results and online messaging to five environmental scientists. All expressed concerns, ranging from what was found in the samples to how they were collected and how the city is portraying the results.
Let me open it up again.
Sam Dorovich was one of them. He's with the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health.
Okay. So I'm looking at a document called Building Debris Galbestos Sampling Asbestos Results.
Dorovich looks at one of the lab reports of samples from the building site. He compares that with results from a little more than a dozen dust samples taken from around the neighborhood.
You see something that says, oh, they tested 14 samples and none of them had asbestos. But at the, you know, on the property, it sounds like they did detect asbestos. If there's an implosion, some of the asbestos is going to fall outside of the demolition site and into the neighborhood.
Dorovich says that to know exactly how much of that material made it onto homes and cars in Little Village, the city would have had to be monitoring the air while the implosion happened, which, if you remember, is exactly what residents asked for at the community meeting, 8 months before the smokestack fell.
The implosion was on April 11th, but it seems that by the time the sampling actually began, the air sampling, the cloud was basically gone. You know, it's like if a chemical spills in the ocean and you wait a couple of days, you know, some of that chemical might have evaporated. Some of that chemical might have sunk to the bottom of the ocean. So you don't really learn very much about how bad things were initially. And that's sort of what happened here. The air testing was done too late.
The caravan picked up late drivers along the route. In total, it stretched to almost 100 cars.
Nice job, everybody. We're huge. Let's make some noise. Honk your horn.
Little Village residents will never get a full picture of what was in the dust that day. Illinois' attorney general sued Hilco. The city issued 16 violations against the company and its contractors. The fines totaled $68,000.
The contractor. But the city gave them a $19.7 million tax break for this development. And so, like, in the grand scheme of things, like, $68,000 is a drop in the bucket.
Mauricio says there were early hints the demolition could have gone wrong. Hilco's contractors had been cited before for letting dust leave the construction site. And last year, a worker from Little Village named Reynaldo Grimaldo fell to his death on the job.
I think while the city is pointing the finger at Hilco and the contractor, they still have to reckon with the fact that they approved this permit. There was a track record. They have to answer to that too.
We asked Mayor Lightfoot's office about all of this. They didn't respond in time before we published this story, but in past statements, the mayor has acknowledged that Little Village residents have felt disrespected for decades. At the very least, Alvejo and the people in this caravan, they want that tax incentive rescinded. And these are people that closed down two coal power plants. They're still fighting for the bigger prize. They want Hilco out of their neighborhood. Elvejo is back to protesting in front of the coal plant, where the city has allowed work to continue on the site. And Kim, she's back on the bullhorn.
Clear the mayor and her administration doesn't give a shit about black and brown lives, having this happen during a respiratory epidemic. What do we want? When do we want it?
For Kim, this all started with one goal, trying to close the coal plants in her city to protect her neighborhood. But what this fight has shown her over the past 20 plus years is just how that problem is tied to so many others. It wasn't just shutting down the coal plants. It was also trying to understand why people were allowed to live near them in the first place. It wasn't just the implosion, but that it happened in a predominantly Latino neighborhood during a pandemic that is killing black and brown people at twice the rate of white people. It's not just Hilco or Target, but the profit-driven system pushing this development and others like it across the country. Kim has realized the work she's doing is against a much bigger adversary.
It's just so much more than just like, it's just one bad person. It's a bad system in general, right? Like, and it's bananas to me that this all came from like the fact that my kid couldn't breathe, right? And now that statement can be expanded across so many different realms. For me personally, I think to get to this point of understanding like how it's all interconnected, right? And like how we don't have a right to say shit about what happens in our neighborhood.
What Kim wants is a world where environmental decisions are made by and with the people who will be impacted. One that recognizes communities like hers are experts in what they need, regardless of how much political power they have or how much money their ideas can bring to the city, which is not a far-fetched thing. Actually, people all over the country are realizing that things don't have to be the way they've always been. Policing, housing, labor, schools. But Kim's story is a lesson in how that kind of change will come about. There is no moment, no singular victory in which there's a before and after. There will be progress, but there will also be setbacks. Because justice is a thing we recreate every day in every collective choice. We're in this for the long haul, and that's a good thing. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was reported by Jenny Casas. It was edited by Christopher Wirth and mixed by Hannes Brown. Our executive producer is Karen Froman. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Marianne McCune, and Vera Lynn Williams, with help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki. Hannes Brown also wrote the theme music for our show. It's performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Please do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.